Tonight on Arena. In TV, Robert De Niro is a former American president in Zero Day, and Stephen Graham is a bare-knuckle fighter in 1,000 Blows. Tonight in our TV review slot, we have a new drama on Netflix, Zero Day, with Robert De Niro starring in his first TV series. In this political thriller, the US has been subjected to a devastating cyber attack that causes thousands of deaths nationwide. De Niro plays George Mullen, a former US president who is tasked with leading a Zero Day commission to unearth the perpetrators. For our second series tonight, we leave the US behind and travel to London, Soho, circa 1920 for a new BBC drama, Dope Girls. It stars Julianne Nicholson as Kate Galloway, a housewife who, following a personal tragedy, leaves her rural home to find a new life in London. What she finds is the seedy life of Soho, where she ends up running a nightclub but having to ward off gangsters and the police. And finally, we are staying in London for 1,000 Blows on Disney Plus. This time we move to the East End and Victorian times in the story of Hezekiah and Alec, best friends newly arrived from Jamaica, who are drawn to the underbelly of the boxing scene to make a living but soon come up against the dangerous boxer Sugar Goodson. And their rivalry spills into the life beyond the ring. Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser have been watching all three and join me now in studio. Let's start, Chris, with Zero Day. Robert De Niro makes his small screen debut, so it must have been quite a script to lure him from Hollywood to the smaller screen.
Yeah, absolutely. He waited until he was 81 to lead his first television series. But he's playing a former US president who was very popular during his time and only served one term. His name is George Mullen, said that he didn't serve a second term. The media takes it that due to a family bereavement, he didn't serve a second term. But you're wondering, was it something else? But when we first meet him, his biggest problem is that he can't finish his memoirs. And his publishers are kind of pushing him a little bit, saying that, you know, they need a draft from him. He says, look, you'll have a draft soon. And we kind of get the feeling that he doesn't want to write about that personal bereavement. But all of that will have to wait, because on the same day he's getting pressure from the publishers, there's a cyber attack in America. And every American receives a message on their phone saying, this will happen again. And it's a 60 second blackout all over the country. The power goes off, basically. And during that minute, you have, the traffic lights stop working, railroad tracks, air traffic control units. So thousands of lives are lost and thousands of others are injured. And you have Mullen essentially pulled out of retirement by both the serving US president, played by Angela Bassett, and also a former right-hand man, played by Jesse Plemons, who are saying, look, you were the most popular president of your time. The people need you to kind of come back now. And also the president, the current president, wants him to front this commission to find the people who are responsible for this cyber attack. Might be the Russians, might be someone close to the home, but the way that they're going to try and find them will be quite controversial.
Okay, let's listen to a clip. Here, President Evelyn Mitchell, played by Angela Bassett, invites the former President George Mullen, played by Robert De Niro, to the White House to discuss the cyber attack.
Usually, a zero-day vulnerability exists on a single operating system, your iPhone, say. But this thing exploited unknown vulnerabilities across dozens of systems. It shut those systems off for exactly 1 minute. And then turned everything back on again.
So that wasn't us?
No. We had barely gotten our people into it when everything came back online.
There was no ransom demand, nobody claimed responsibility, nothing like that.
Just that insidious threat. We're running shifts at me trying to sort through a digital trail that is basically the Gordian knot.
So what's the plan?
Congress is authorizing a special investigatory commission and endowing it with extraordinary powers commensurate with the scale of this emergency. They will be granting this commission powers of surveillance, powers of search and seizure, if necessary, even the suspension of habeas corpus.
Jesus, Evelyn, we didn't even do that after 9/11.
This is different. We knew who did it then. We have no clue here and no time to spare. We need an entity with all the powers of every law enforcement and intelligence agency put together operating on American soil.
You're just going to grab people off the streets without warrants?
Actually, you are.
There we have President Evelyn Mitchell being rather hawkish. She's been played by Angela Bassett and George Mullen there looking for some kind of calm. So on top of the setup that Chris so well explained there, there are complications, both personal in the life of this former president, mm-hmm. George Mullen, and then there are political complications as well. Like, is it the Russians or is it some other nasty cyber attack people?
Maybe the call is coming from inside the house, America. Imagine. And in that kind of scenario, you have Dan Stevens' character. He is Evan Green, and he's like this broadcaster who broadcasts from his basement, ostensibly, but it's the basement of his mansion. So let's think, you know, it's like your Ben Shapiro kind of style mixed with Alex Jones. So he's this conspiracy theorist who's the thorn in Mullen's side, and he's always, you know, questioning his methods and especially the harshness of what the commission want to do, the zero-day commission, and, you know, calling out his previous track record as well. But then there's, so he has him to kind of deal with because he's constantly on his case and has a massive audience. Then there's subsidiary characters. Now, it sounds crazy to call, you know, any role that Jesse Plemons is in as a subsidiary character, but he is. He's Roger Carlson, and as Chris said, he is like this slippery kind of tricksy advisor to Mullen. He convinces him to take the job, but you never exactly know what Carlson is up to. Like, is it self-interest? To what end? And he's mixing with this shady tech billionaire. Is there any other kind of tech billionaire except a shady one? Richard Lyndon. And we don't know what a hand he has to play in all of this and the control. But then you also have on the other side of things Mullen's daughter, Alexandra, who's played by the great Lizzie Kaplan, and she's a congresswoman in her own right. She wants to step out from the shadow of her famous father, who is so influential. Is like, you know, the whole thing about this is it's so broad. It's like kind of America in disarray. What would you want more than Daddy De Niro to step up and be president? And that's really what the theme is here in that way, especially in that relationship.
Because he is very much a Daddy De Niro in this. He is somebody you would trust. Not exactly the type of role De Niro is often cast in.
No, that's true. And he has been talking about, well, in the interviews that he's been doing, because I feel like a lot of press have been trying to get him to talk about, you know, what's going on in the real world and kind of real world parallels with the sort of like paranoia and an anger that we see in Zero Day from the American public. But instead, he's been talking about the fact that maybe he was inspired a little bit by Jimmy Carter, you know, a president that everyone would have liked, who, you know, who he thinks was a good man and a kind man. And George Mullen is very much a good man and a kind man. There might be some, you know, unusual skeletons in his closet, and he might not have, you know, behaved very well at home at times, but he wants what's best for his country, and he believes that by kind of stepping into the breach again, he won't hurt his legacy. And his daughter, played by Lizzie Kaplan, thinks that he might, because he's very much the old school and the rules of change, and the media will do anything to tarnish his legacy. I think it's and also the subject that we're kind of tiptoeing around. I don't think we're spoiling anything here. There are signs that he might be, you know, there might be dementia there as well. There are signs that his mind is beginning to slip.
Yes, he keeps these notebooks, and sometimes there seems to be rubbish written in the notebooks, and other times they look like the diary of his presidency, which he leaves hanging around.
You shouldn't leave them hanging around, George. No. Not in your library, not anywhere. But also, that's a touch of the Joe Biden's about that then, because it's like, how old is too old to serve like in political office? So that's another factor to calling him back in. Can he actually complete the job and do it well and do it successfully and get out of it as cleanly as possible? And you don't kind of know what side his daughter is on sometimes, because they have a fractious relationship. You think, you know, she wants to make a name for herself, and could she make a name for herself by taking her own father down? So that's another kind of edge to the story as well. But it's all very well done, but it's kind of like a 90s video shop thriller.
But it is hard to watch without making those comparisons.
Oh,
Angela Bassett seems like Kamala Harris.
Very wishful thinking on the writer's part. It's really wishful thinking.
Yes, although she seems hawkish in, she seems to really want to go and nuke the Russians very quickly.
But also the idea of De Niro, there's a great scene in here where De Niro's George Mullen, you know, he's encouraged to go to New York, talk to the firefighters who are trying to help people who are trapped in a rubble beneath the streets, and let the Americans know that, you know, they're not alone. And all of a sudden they're like angry, you know, there's an angry mob, people spouting all of these conspiracies, saying, oh, the people that are hurt are actually actors. Unfortunately, that's the kind of thing that you do see in the real world. And De Niro's Mullen just stops and makes this impromptu speech that goes viral, and that's what gets Mitchell's attention in the first place. And you're thinking to yourself, this is very far-fetched that a former president would just stop in the streets and say this thing, you know, without a script in front of him. But that's the kind of thing that De Niro actually does in real life sometimes when he's interviewed about, you know, just promoting a film. So I quite like that De Niro got to do that. Yes, he's playing someone who is very kind, but he's also, like, you do believe that he would have been president.
Oh,
that 100%. He has the power, like.
Okay, well, we talked to the wonderful Joan Allen, who plays Sheila, George's wife, yesterday. And let's listen to a clip where George and Sheila discuss the commission and his role as the head of it.
Sorry, I got held up. I think that's the last of the stragglers.
You deserve more. We'll make up for it when it's Chief Justice.
It was fine, George. You must be exhausted.
So?
No question. It is a trap, politically. Mitchell has to take decisive action, and she knows that there is a good chance that half the country will end up hating whoever takes this on.
I can't let that stop me.
You are the smart play.
Everyone says that. They want the truth, but the reality is it's better for both sides if the blame can't be pinned on anyone. That way they can just keep on blaming each other.
Is that your analysis?
No, that's our daughter. She says they're weaponizing the crisis.
We both know she can be prone to hyperbole. Mm. Though, in this case, I don't think that comes close to capturing it. This commission is the single greatest affront to civil liberties anyone has ever attempted.
Okay, well, that's it then. I tell Mitchell, no, I'm not going to do it.
That's why you have to do it. They've already weaponized it. And who else do you want with their finger on the trigger?
So Joan Allen there as Sheila and Robert De Niro as George. So performance-wise, I mean, he's carrying, even though there's these fantastic array of characters and actors, how do you think De Niro carries the show?
Oh, very well. He said that, I mean, it's so strange that, like, 81 and you're fronting a television show. And there is this, you know, image of De Niro I have as, and maybe he had it himself, as a movie star. And, you know, movie stars should be movie stars and television stars should stay in their box. But that's sort of impossible now. Television is so much bigger than cinema. And he said that it was like, you know, shooting three films. And I was a little bit like, oh, is this going to be like watching three films? Is it going to be a bit saggy? It is in parts, but never when De Niro is involved. And that's, and I'm so relieved to say that too, because he says yes to a lot of bad films. But here he's on form. He's playing, so he's allowed as well to play someone who, again, as I said, is powerful, but there are cracks there. There is a vulnerability there. And he's very good during the tender moments, either, you know, with his daughter, with his wife, and then also very good at playing someone who you don't want to mess with, who does have some very powerful allies.
And I think Joan Allen is great. I think the thing about Joan Allen is she's very underrated, because what she does, you know, it's not flashy, it's not showy, but she really gets under the skin of this character who has her own, you know, career that she wants to. She wants to be part of the Supreme Court, and this is all putting, like, kind of that on axis in a way. And Joan Allen was actually in this great, another presidential thriller called The Contender, which I think people, if they haven't seen, it's actually such a brilliant film, and she's brilliant in it. And I think someone like, you know, Jesse Plemons, as I said, just to have him in a side role, he's so watchable, and he's so crafty in this. And I have to say, Dan Stevens, brilliant as well. They both are so well done. But I do think the thing about it is it falls on the side of romanticism, and it is like a centrist fantasy. Like, if The West Wing is like a liberal fantasy or a democratic fantasy, this is more like a centrist fantasy. And it's, you know, especially where patriotism is concerned, and it feels a little bit old fashioned when, like, De Niro is talking about doing things for the good of the country, and lots of scenes of the military and the CIA and politicians want to come together for the good to fight the enemy. And I think, you know, we're living in a very different time.
Exactly. It almost seems like a soapbox.
It's a fantasy.
Times.
Yeah.
Stars out of five from you, Chris.
Yeah, good stuff from De Niro. A bit implausible at times, probably an episode too long, but we'll go with a solid three.
Three. And from you, Jen?
Yeah, three. There's twists, there's red herrings, there's a lot of tension, and there is great acting to get dug into.
Now we're going on to, loosely based on Marek Cohn's 1992 novel of the same name, Dope Girls, transports us back to post-World War I London and the women who were such a vital part of the community when they took over the men's jobs while they fought the war. They're now trying to hold onto their autonomy. Julian Nicholson plays Kate Galloway, a tenacious widow trying to support her family, and Violet Davis is Eliza Scanlon, a tough northern woman who wants to make something of herself. So, Jen, Dope Girls are women on the last rung of the ladder, really, aren't they? They're fighting off their past, the law, gangsters, to try and climb their way up.
It's a lot of female rage here, definitely. And at the start of every episode, you see one character screaming before the title sequence comes up. And I think, you know, that's what you need to know, because there are these women that, as you said, you know, World War One has just ended. They were keeping the country going. They were working in munitions factories. Like, taking their husbands' jobs, becoming central, the focal points of communities, and then they're thrown to the side, they're thrown into disarray. Now the men are home, it's like, go back to, you know, the kitchen or whatever. And they want these women, the trio women within Dope Girls, want to stake their claim on this world. They don't want to let that slip away from themselves. So you do have Julianne Nicholson as Kate Galloway, and she has to basically abandon her dreams of like running this shop, like working in a shop. And it seems very small, you know, when you think about it, when you see what happens to her. But after, like, her husband dies by suicide, she is effectively left homeless because she's evicted. Her and her teenage daughter, Evie, they're both evicted. So she's pounding the streets of London, desperately looking for a place to live, and ends up knocking on the door of Billy, who is this good time girl. She is a chancer, a dancer, a bon vivant, and she...
living in the most amazing boho apartment, and seems to have a most wonderful lifestyle until we find out what funds that, which is this awful underbelly of Soho life.
So she does like do a neat sideline as a cocaine dealer in this very seedy bar in Soho where she dances. And, you know, Kate then, by association through Billy, gets thrown into this world of, you know, new opportunities, and also like trying to fight for her independence with her child, but also, you know, comes up against gangsters and people, you know, the seediest underbelly of London. So Kate cooks up this idea to start running a club with Billy after they end up in a dust-up with this infamous crime family called the Salucci's, or one particular member of the Salucci family. So the girls make off with his money and they want to start up this club. And obviously you're like, is this going to end well? Probably not.
Well, let's listen to a clip. There's quite strong language in this because the very same vile character you were talking about, Silvio is here, and Kate has joined the troupe of dancers. They wear these little wings, and he's mocking her because she's older. And then the Billy character stands up for her.
Where should I start?
Get your granny out of here. Oh, that's amazing. Thank you. She'd scare off the customers.
Where'd you get off speaking to people like that? Because you don't fool me, you pencil-dick little fuck. You and Lars are second in our shoes.
I'm glad you've let me know how you feel. Thank you. Now put your little wings on, get on that stage, and show them your tits. Because that is your fucking job.
Yes, he has it coming to him. That's Silvio, played by Sebastian Croft there. The men are a bad lot in this, Chris.
Oh, yeah, they are, anyway.
He's one example of it. And then he's from this horrendous family of gangsters.
The Salucci. I mean, this series has been described by someone in BBC, I'd love to know who it is, as the spiritual successor to Peaky Blinders, which is just a way to get the Peaky Blinders audience in. But if you're kind of wondering, like, where are the male gangsters in this, that's the Salucci's. And unfortunately, when Kate and Billy, when they get on the wrong side of Salucci's, when they threaten somebody, if they threaten to do something to somebody, they tend to follow through. So they are a rotten bunch. But there's also a rotten bunch in the police force in this, and that's where the other side of the story comes in, with Eliza Scanlon playing a character named Violet Davies. And she's a young woman in London. For every time a new character is introduced, writing comes up on the screen to let you know how long they've been in that place for, how many robberies or crimes they've committed, very much as, you know, from the book. But Violet Davies, she wants to be a police officer. They're introducing women into the police force. She makes through, you know, various controversial means, she makes the final 10, and you just know, without giving too much away, that she's going to cross paths with Kate and actually sort of infiltrate the club that Billy and Kate are setting up. So she thinks she wants to be a police officer, and that she's doing the right thing working for these horrible men. She will eventually, maybe, you just know, cross over to the other side.
Now, Jen, there's a lot of violence in this, and a lot of it is very graphic, and then there's a lot of women doing a lot of violent things in their underwear.
Yeah.
Were you at times you thought there's an awful lot of business going on? It's very showy at times.
And I think it's beautiful looking though. I do. I mean, I think it's the way the camera work, it's a very arresting production from the get-go. Like, there's the sets are really well designed and very striking cinematography. There's a gorgeous scene where Kate at the end ends up covered in blood, won't say why, wearing a pair of angel wings, and she dips herself into the fountain in Trafalgar Square as the celebrations are all around her, swirling around her from the end of the war. And it's just gorgeous to look at. And it felt like, you know, it could be a photograph, like it felt like a painting. Like, and I don't want to sound like a broken record because I've said this before in the show, but it does stylistically owe a lot to Babylon Berlin. And I seriously, everybody needs to watch Babylon Berlin. But
I think you've said that before on this show.
Yes, yeah. I have. And like, it's Babylon Berlin's Lotta, her, the main character, is like a mix between the wildness of Billy and the frustrated Violet, because Lotta is a dancer in and an escort in a club, but she also wants to be a policewoman in Babylon Berlin. And that's like a mix of these two characters, Billy and Violet. Now, I do think Eliza Scanlon's Violet is the actual crux of the show. I think she is the one to watch. She is so ruthless and scandalous and violent and tough, but like, and there's a part of her that you know is going to break, because she's left behind a very turbulent family life. Her sister has died under very, I think, violent circumstances, and she won't stand for it anymore. So you always feel she's on the edge of breaking point. And then she comes up against this Sergeant Frank Turner, played by Ian Bonner, and the relationship between the two of them, the tension between the two of them, is sometimes excruciating, and it's very hard to watch because it is about that grind and misogyny of the time, where he wants to make a fool of her, where he wants her to feel completely undone and diminished. And there is something really important to watch in that, and I think very interesting in that story and that dynamic. I do think, though, the other characters could be built up a little bit more outside of hers.
Chris, overall, what did you make of it in Stars?
Yeah, I thought it was a little over-stylized in places, a bit over-directed. Sort of, you know, the kind of trippy music video-like visuals and the modern score sometimes annoyed me, but it does settle. It does eventually find the tone. And Julian Nicholson, this is the second time in 3 weeks, I think we've discussed Julian Nicholson. She's also she also has a hit on Paradise on Disney. She is the most valuable player here. You know, just I'd stick with it for her. So, 3 stars, I think.
3 from you. And for you?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I sometimes think I'll tip into 3.5 because I really enjoyed watching this. I really want to see what happens.
You sounded as though you liked it more than 3.5.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that would put me off is the fact that I want the other characters to have their kind of more three-dimensional, as much as Violet can be. And I think she, for me, is the star of the show, whereas I guess it's supposed to be Kate and Billy as well, whereas I feel like they're secondary characters. And I could do without the writing on the screen telling you who's friends with who or whatever. Dispense with that and it would have been higher, but I do think it's something people could get swept away with.
Okay, 3 and 3.5 for Dope Girls, and that's on BBC One. Now, A Thousand Blows is another London-based drama and the latest from Peaky Blinders creator Stephen Knight. It's set in the East End in the late Victorian era this time. It stars Stephen Graham as Henry Sugar Goodson. He's Wapping's bare-knuckle fighting champion, and Erin Doherty is Mary Carr, the leader of the real-life gang of female thieves known as 40 Elephants. Into this scene arrives Malachi Kirby and Frances Lovehall as best friends, Hezekiah and Alex. They're just off the boat from Jamaica. So this is another underworld story from earlier in, you know, the previous century, obviously. And like, all these characters are real characters, but they may not be, they've taken some license in how they know each other and the coming together of them.
Yeah, absolutely. A little bit like Dope Girls, which is inspired by real characters and real stories, but it's, you know, it's a work of fiction. But this is Stephen Knight's version of the 1880s, which is to say things get a little Dickensian at times, a bit too much so. But you have Hezekiah and Alec, played by Malachi Kirby and Frances Lovehall. As you say, they're off the boat. They have this idea. They've come from Jamaica. You know, they've had this brutal, bloody past that they're trying to push back and create a future for themselves. Hezekiah, in particular, has this dream to become a lion tamer, and he has this promise from maybe a zookeeper that he can make that happen. Long story short, and a very long story short, because it takes an awful long time, as he usually does, for Knight to kind of pick his players and set up the board. That dream does not come true for Hezekiah, and he falls back on his second talent, which is he's a very good fighter, and he steps into the ring of we have this pub owner and bare knuckle boxing champion, Goodman, Sugar Goodman, played by the brilliant Stephen Graham. And you're not supposed to win a fight against Goodman, and nobody told Hezekiah that. And although maybe he doesn't even win the fight, he makes a show of him in the ring. So it all becomes about, you know, Goodman trying to get his own back on Hezekiah, but also Mary Carr, or played by Erin Doherty, Mary Carr is her name. She is the leader of the 40 Elephants that you mentioned. She sees something. She has a connection already.
And who are the 40 Elephants?
40 Elephants is a female-led crime syndicate. And the sort of gangsters who will rob you blind on the street when you don't even, when you're not even paying attention, but they'll also rob a department store in broad daylight. So they don't really care where they're getting their, where they're getting the goods from. They will just get them. But she has this huge plan for the 40 Elephants. She's going to take them from underground into the mainstream, and she thinks, I could use a guy like Hezekiah.
Okay, well, let's listen to Hezekiah and Alex. They're just off the boat. They now think that they might not become a lion tamer, but end up in the boxing ring.
Yeah. Believe in fate, right?
What?
You could earn some money in the ring tonight.
No, no, Hezekiah, no.
You were good.
You were better.
Them call it a Maran Bear whirlwind.
Only you call me that. And every time we fight, you win.
My position already filled, right? And now,
so is yours.
Look, I'm going to fight lions. All you have to do is box that white man. Our luck has changed.
Yeah.
Leave this to me. Soon come.
There we go. There's Malachy Kirby and Francis Lovehall there in a scene from A Thousand Blows. So Chris there was saying, Jen, that it's very Dickensian.
It is.
So is that Stephen Knight's version of Dickens, or...
It feels like it is, because, I mean, I think, you know, what we're kind of dancing around maybe is Erin Doherty is a great actress. I think she's exceptional. We'll know, you know, from Princess Anne in The Crown. Like, I just think she's very adaptable. But the Mary Carr character can be a bit oversized at times, as in she is like this female Fagin with her band of sisters who are pickpockets, you know, and are ready to be on, you know, the lam. And that can feel a bit overdone, yeah, it can, at times, but, and that's the silliness of it. And I think, you know, because she is such a good actress, it kind of acts almost, it is a bit outlandish, but it acts as this kind of comic relief a little bit, or just release from the violence, the full on violence you were getting with
this
barnacle
boxing.
Yeah, yes. So she's the flip side of that, and she is involved, and I like, you know, her moxie. I like the way that she has this swagger about her, and she's very believable. And I think, you know, her and when her and Malachy Kirby are together, I think they're great together. I think, but he is the emotional core of this, Malachy Kirby, and he's the emotional center. Like, this could be a very knockabout, you know, pun intended, story, but it, or a lightweight story, but he grounds it in this reality, because you're with him all the way, because you're thinking, God, you know, he was so diminished, and everything that he came from was so horrifically, you know, played out, and then to end up in London, and that struggle of an immigrant is well done. I think it's really well done. And the brothership between him and Alex, between him and Francis Lovehall, they are great together. I think they're a great duo. And then you have Stephen Graham on top of it all. I mean, my God, Stephen Graham, he is, you know, literally, he gives characters texture, is the only way I can say.
Because
that man is a phenomenal actor.
He's thuggish in this. It's a thuggish role.
He is, but like, under his furrowed brows is a hangdog expression. Those hangdog eyes that could either, you know, be so sad or really defiant. And like, there's something about him even just looking at somebody that you can get so much from. And that is the mark of a great actor. And I think he gives it that heft too. And you want to see what happens with his character and how it plays out. And, you know, that's, Stephen Knight has that with a troupe of great actors. And I think that's what makes you continue with it, which was something that could be seen as a bit ridiculous, I suppose, from
it
the
could,
outside.
Yeah, I think it was Stephen Graham as well, though. He's a terrific actor, and he always plays intimidating characters that you're just watching on screen, whether it's the big screen, small screen, you think, I wouldn't get too close to him. But with this, the physical transformation is the next step. I think the physical transformation, Stephen Graham working with boxing trainers, going to the gym, bulking up, I think it's the last piece in the scary Stephen Graham act. So, like, there are times where here, like, he's a mountain of a man in this. And Malachy Kirby stands over him, because he is quite short, but he stands over him. And there are times where I thought Malachy Kirby was scared of Graham, and you would be if you got that close. So it's, but saying all that, it all, you know, you can bulk up as much as you want, but if the performance is not there, if the acting ability, but it's Stephen Graham, so you know it
so
is.
So even though it's broad in parts, you think, you know, in terms of acting and overdoing it, you think it's well worth a watch.
Oh yeah, they're pros and cons.
It's enjoyable.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, weirdly, I know that sounds strange because it is so violent, and I will say, like, it's not for the faint-hearted. There are scenes where you see eye gouging. There's a particular scene where someone gets bitten that it kind of feels like it goes on for a long time. So I would say word of warning, but but in its own way, it is enjoyable because it's a romp. It's a bit of a, like, it's a tall tale in that
it
way.
Is, yeah.
And it flies along.
Stars has 5 from you, Chris.
It's a tall tale, as Jen said, but it's told well. Graham, Kirby, Grace, the staging, it is a bit stagey, the actual sets. It never looks like, it always looks like a set, basically. But I'll stick with it. 3 stars.
Yep. 3 stars from you and from you.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's stick it on of a Friday night, you know, and you will be entertained for sure. I mean, Stephen Knight knows what he's doing. I mean, he has Stephen Graham on board, of course he does. So, 3.
So, you can see Zero Day on Netflix, Dope Girls on BBC One, and 1,000 Blows on Disney. Chris Wasser and Jen Gannon, thank you. You're listening to Friday Night's Arena, so it's album review time. Irish band The Murder Capital pushed beyond their post-punk roots in their 3rd album, Blindness, recorded in Los Angeles. The album reflects the band's scattered roots across Ireland, London and Europe. For Sam Fender, People Watching marks his return after the massive success of 17 Going Under. Fender's 3rd album balances introspection with stadium-sized rock, with a touch of Springsteen-inspired storytelling and social commentary. Tate McRae is in the midst of a rapid ascent, releasing her 3rd album, So Close to What, in just 4 years. A dancer-turned-pop star, she fully embraces every 2000s influence on her new release. I'm joined by Sarah Hederman and Kian Sullivan, who've been listening to all 3. Let's start with the Irish band, The Murder Capital, and the track Death of a Giant.
Black horse in the center of the street, marching solemnly in grief, while the lithy leaves its sleep. Young band marching slowly on their feet. The chemist sings to the whole street while the shining moves beneath. Yeah. It was the death of a giant. The death of a giant. It was the death of a giant. The death of a giant. On their head marked the permanence of death as the living moved it wet. Young band marching slowly on their feet. The chemist sings the songs we seek while the shining starts to weep. Yeah. It was the death of a giant.
That's Death of a Giant from The Murder Capital's 3rd album, Blindness. And that song recalls in memory of Shane McGowan's funeral, as remembered by Murder Capital's James McGovern. Zara Hederman and Kian Sullivan have been listening to The Murder Capital. Zara, this album was recorded in LA under the stewardship of producer John Coglinton. But he decided to shake things up a bit, didn't he? That they wouldn't do the usual demoing of songs before they recorded them.
Yeah, and actually quite different, because they worked with John Coglinton in the previous album, Gigi's Recovery, in 2023. And I was surprised to see him give that advice to not demo. And I don't know actually how beneficial that was to the band, because I felt that this album was very much underdeveloped a lot of the time. Like, even that song that we heard, Death of a Giant, as you mentioned, is about kind of the passing of Shane McGowan and celebrating him. But it's very limited in the description of what McGovern experienced, or even how McGowan impacted him. Like, all we really get is Black Horse with Black Feathers on its head. And I would have liked him to kind of go beyond that, like maybe even talk about the influence of him on his work. And even musically, I thought it was a bit of a misstep. And that was something that I felt throughout the 11 songs. Like, they said that they wrote them in the space of 10 days, and in some cases writing two or three songs. And to me, the rushed nature of that really came across, because he talks about his lyrical inspirations. Like, even later on, there's Love of Country, which is about kind of xenophobia and what makes someone love their country, and also the hatred that that can incite for another. And listening to that, it just really kind of insisted upon itself for, you know, feeling its importance, but not really saying a lot. And I even think that vocally too, like, I think we heard it in Death of a Giant, his vocals don't sound anywhere near up to scratch, which is a shame, because I think their previous work has been quite interesting.
Cian, that track, Death of a Giant, and then as Zara was talking about Love of Country, they're both inspired by kind of public events, the death of Shane McGowan, and then the Dublin riots in the case of Love of Country. But there's a lot of introspective songs here as well.
Yeah. I think, you know, like, this, the 10 days, I think, would have happened around the time, because I think Shane McGowan's passing and those Dublin riots were within 10 days of each other. So I think that was probably what was kind of inspiring them to write music as well. But, you know, Words Lost Meaning is more of a reflection on a relationship which seems to be maybe spiraling out of control. There's a track called The Fall, which has these like untethered bursts of drumming from the drummer Dermot Brennan, which sort of echoes this character who's pugnacious, is kind of on a bit of an ego overdrive. And while recording this album, the band actually had a real life argument in the studio, which actually ate up some of their studio time, which may have been to the behest, as Zara was saying there. And I wonder whether that song was inspired, or, you know, was reflected on or altered after that fight of
yes, because they live separately now. You know, they live in different places in the world. Not that that means that they're separate as a band.
Yeah.
But maybe then the coming together might have been a bit more fraught.
Possibly. I mean, like, one's in Berlin, one's in London, touring County Donegal. You know, they, in the press release, they're kind of talking about how coming together, having lived these separate lives, was a boon creatively for writing the songs. But maybe when they all went away, had, you know, speculating, but maybe, yeah, that ultimately then had its own frictions when they went to record it.
What did you think of what Zara was saying about the James McGovern's writing in this?
Well, I kind of agree to a certain degree in that there isn't a lot of storytelling. I felt the songs were more of a vibe. I feel like they were very much songs written to be performed live. I got a really good sense that I might not really fully understand this album until I see it and I hear it in a tent with speakers. I listened to it a lot. I really was hoping the songs would percolate into the brain. They haven't really yet, but I do think if you're going to see them and if you get tickets to their show, I don't think they're going to disappoint live.
Yes, sorry, it's strange, isn't it? It's like the album finishes with stronger songs than it begins. I think you both felt that.
Yeah, absolutely. I was kind of, in my repeated listens, losing a bit of patience with it, but every time that closing trio of Swallow That Feeling and Trailing Wind Wing came along, I was really relieved, because I loved what they were doing musically, because I think musically they are excellent musicians and they create such a great atmosphere. And like Cian was saying, they are meant to be an incredible live prospect. I mean, they're about to headline Ivy Gardens this summer, so it's no surprise there. And there were, like, the highlights for me in this were Dermot Brennan's drumming. He's an incredible drummer. There's some really great guitar tones employed throughout. So musically, there's great ideas going on. But I did find it interesting as well. Maybe it's a case of, this is the third album. They've done a lot in the first 5 years of being a band. Like, they only formed in 2018. This is their third album. And I just felt that maybe exhaustion had caught up with them, and that kind of hunger of things to write about was maybe just not there in the same way. Because for me, this was the weakest of their albums. Like, I think that their second album, Gigi's Recovery, which they worked with the same producer, is a much more developed, it's a much more realised, cohesive body of work as well from start to finish. And it really just demonstrated to me that time really is the kind of the essence for them as a band.
Yeah, Gigi's Recovery did win a slew of awards, Cian. Do you think, again, they're stalling a bit here, or do you see progression?
Yeah, I mean, they kind of talk about how Gigi's Recovery took them 9 months to write in this house in Wexford, and were they kind of overanalyzing it, or were they getting caught up in their own thoughts in pursuit of perfection, and that this album in contrast, was very spur of the moment, very, you know, instinct, driven. But yeah, I think maybe a bit more time would have benefited them.
OK, from you, Cian, stars out of five for The Murder Capital.
Yeah, I think this will sound great live. I just don't know if I'm going to re-listen to it in studio form. It's 3 stars from me.
3 stars from you. And from you, Zara?
It's just a bit underdeveloped and I know that they can do better. So it was a 2.5 for me.
So that's Blindness by The Murder Capital. And we have Sam Fender and Tate McRae after the break.
RTE Radio 1. You got a 9 to 5. Lucy Dacus. So I'll take the night. Live at Ivy Gardens, July 3rd. Subject to venue license. I'm not going to stop you. I'm not going to stop you this time, baby. Tickets available now. Heavy memories weighing on my brain. Hot and heavy in the basement. Presented by Aiken Promotions. Music updates on RTE Radio 1. This weekend in the Irish Times, Pamela Anderson talks to Tara Brady. Following her gritty performance in The Last Showgirl, is she finally getting the respect she deserves? In Magazine, Belfast star Jamie Dornan tells Niamh Donnelly why he always feels he has a point to prove. And in Sport, Dennis Walsh reflects on the devastating loss of jockey Michael O'Sullivan and the profound impact his death has had on the racing world. Buy in store or get it delivered to your door. The Irish Times, because you get it.
An arena, we're listening to albums. Cian Sullivan and Zara Hedeman have had their headphones on. Now, 4 years after his last album, 17 Going Under, Sam Fender returned with People Watching, a stadium-ready album that blends his signature Springsteen-inspired sounds with storytelling about everyday lives and personal struggles. Let's listen to Wild Long Lie.
As he rails one again and turns to me, says Martin, Boris and Jan, full police gear tonight. He said it's told by sentences that was a train, but we seen how that went down stateside. It didn't fly. It's that time of the year again when your past comes home and everybody you've ever known wants it lost. Jimmy's in my ear again with a motor mouth. God, I love the kid, but we need to slow it down.
Wild Long Lie there from People Watching, from Sam Fender, and Cian Sullivan and Zara Hedeman are with me. Now, he took his time, Cian, getting this album together. And as we were saying, it does veer into, you know, his love of Americana and Bruce Springsteen and the like.
Yeah, absolutely. So 17 Going Under was a real breakthrough kind of for him into the consciousness, especially in the UK. The title track was a really big hit for him. It just kind of really upped his public profile. And I imagine record labels, I'm speculating here, might have been pushing him for a follow-up. But he was really determined that he would rather an album be good and late than early and bad. And yeah, look, throughout his career, Sam Fender has really shown his love for Springsteen and the Killers. You know, there's been kind of other sounds tied in there, but this album really goes in on one of his other influences, which is the war on drugs, and that is by bringing in producer Adam Granduccio. Is that how we pronounce it? I've only ever seen it written down. But yeah, you know, he's really lent into this big Americana sound. And I even think he's even pared back the Geordie accent a bit. Like, this smatterings of Britpop in there, but I feel like he's just really dialed up the Americana dial.
Right. And I think you thought there was maybe a twang too much and a little bit too much, a bit countryish, too countryish.
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, that song in particular, I just found it a little bit too twee. But listening to it again there on the speakers in the studio, you really hear how the War on Drugs influence has come through in it, especially with those staggered piano lines. And I found it really interesting that it was Adam Granduccio's first time actually producing for someone outside of the War on Drugs. And they bonded over like Tom Petty, The Replacements, Springsteen, of course. And I do think it's a good pairing. I do think they work together well. I also think that like part of the issue with this album sonically, I found, was maybe Fender was trying to do sonically a little bit too much. And it just made it a little busy sometimes, because even though like his music wouldn't necessarily be to my tastes, like I wouldn't listen to him in my free time, I do appreciate that he is an important artist to like that time that we're talking about between albums. He's also someone who talks quite a lot about mental health and his own struggles with mental health. He's cancelled tours to prioritise his health, but also in his lyrics he talks a lot about, you know, the UK government and the impact that has on, you know, working class families and villages. There's also a song, the title track on this, which I thought was really interesting. He was writing about a woman who he described as like a surrogate mother to him. And he would go and visit her when she was in palliative care. And he talks about in that song how the place was understaffed and falling apart. And, you know, that's a commentary on the NHS not being funded. So I think it's really important to have artists like Sam Fender writing songs that are about politics, about life, especially in how they shape his perspectives on even relationships and such.
Yes, I'm going to play some of Crumbling Empire. That's one of those key in where he's going back to his Geordie roots and looking at the state of Britain, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like a lot of, on this album, he's in tension as to where he finds home. You know, he doesn't feel like he fits in North Shields anymore. He goes back, he talks about it feeling not like a home anymore, but then he also remembers it fondly on Remember My Name, where he laments his kind of grandparents and how their council house was a sanctuary for him. On this song, there's a line, "My mother delivered most of the kids in this town. My stepdad drove in a tank for the Crown. They left them homeless down and out in their crumbling empire." So a scathing indictment of the government of the UK.
Okay, so let's listen to some of Crumbling Empire. Crumbling Empire there from people watching Sam Fender's new album. So you can hear that, you can hear the Springsteen influence, but you can also hear very clearly the lyrics there, which are very much about Britain.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, he says in that song, "I don't wear the shoes I used to walk in." So, you know, he's dealing with his own privilege as well. Like, he got to get out, he got to have a successful career, he gets to tour the country, he gets to be a rock star. Mm. And I think he has a bit of survivor's guilt when he goes back and he sees people who don't get to the same opportunities as him.
Do you think they work together, the style and the content of what he wants to sing about, Sarah?
I do, because like even there, like with that song, that clip, as I said, I'm not a Sam Fender fan, but when that chorus kicked in, I was humming along and singing away to it. So I do think it is really effective to have those big like hook choruses, because if it gets people cognizant of the words that he's singing and singing it back, like that's like politics and music is such an integral kind of partnership. So I do think he does it effectively here.
So from you, Sarah, stars out of 5 for people watching?
I went for a 3 because I thought that there were some tonal elements like Remember Me at the end just stuck out kind of as a sore thumb on this musically.
TV Dinner as well.
Exactly. Yeah, TV Dinner too. There's just elements where he tries to do something different that it doesn't always work. But I do commend like his bravery for what he talks about.
Kian.
I really enjoyed it. I think maybe it's his favourite offering from him. I think he's managed to bed a lot of these songs in really solid, strong song structures. You know, harking back to the Murder Capital, I listened to this a lot and I found, you know, those grooves and those hooks were embedded in my head. Where I think he loses out, like obviously he's a huge Springsteen fan. I think with every Born in the USA comes a Nebraska, I think he needs to dial it down a bit. I think he needs to let us in a bit more, and I think he'd be on for a winner. So 4 stars.
4 stars from you, 4 and 3 stars for Sam Fender. And finally to Tate McRae, her third album, So Close to What, sees the rising star embrace early 2000s influences, bending dance-focused production with an exploration of relationships and self-discovery. But she has been accused on the internet of reheating Nelly Furtado's nachos. Kian, tell me, why is she being accused of reheating Nelly's nachos?
Right, so the meme of Nelly Furtado's nachos, so reheating
nachos.
Reheating nachos basically is because when you reheat them, you don't get the same crisp, you don't get the same quality, so you can't really recreate it to the same standard. And what they're accusing her of is it's sort of aping and duping Nelly Furtado, but not as well.
So she is a fantastic dancer.
Yeah.
And that's where she started out, in one of those reality shows.
Yeah, So You Think You Can Dance. Yeah.
Yes. And then she embraced singing.
Yeah, she did. Yeah. So and even before that show, she was in the Berlin State Ballet. Like, she's been dancing all her life. And then kind of, I think once she got a taste of fame, she turned to YouTube and she started singing as well, which, you know, this is kind of late 2010s. A lot of people have come up that way between Shawn Mendes and Justin Bieber. So, yeah, she starts singing and she's been reheating nachos her whole career, if we're going to keep using that analogy, because...
But other people's nachos.
Yeah, other people's Nelly's. Nachos. Billie Eilish's nachos, Olivia Rodrigo's nachos. So she's kind of been a bit of a dupe for other artists. And this time around, she's dialing back the clock to early 2000s and, yeah, giving that a whirl in the microwave.
OK, well, let's listen to Sports Car and we'll see what Sarah will spot. There from So Close to What by Tate McRae. I've seen her dancing in the videos to this album. I mean, she is a wonderful performer. Is that very hard for her then to be considered in her own right as a singer?
Absolutely. And she has been actually quite vocal and open about this. She's talked numerously about how she is struggling to incorporate dance with her music. And she has said that like she's really looking to try and find that perfect formula. And I do think on this album, going to that like early 2000s sonic palette, she does well to like make songs that sound like, you know, Britney Spears would have had, or like even Sports Car. The Nachos once belonged to the Pussycat Dolls.
I have that too. She's yes. a one-woman Pussycat Doll.
Yeah, she is. And yeah. like what was interesting with Sports Car in particular was that that song came out in 2005 and Tate McRae would have been one when that came out. And I did see an interview she gave last year and she was asked if she could live through any era of music, what it would have been. She said the early 2000s, and that made me feel incredibly old.
All right, so she's singing about the songs and the singers she loved.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. Yeah. And she has like her record label have really done an excellent job of having the right people around her to help get that sound. Like here we've got Ryan Tedder, we have Amy Allen, who's an very successful songwriter. She's worked with Sabrina Carpenter, Harry Styles, Billie Eilish, and Phineas wrote a song for her first EP. So she has that kind of strong production behind her. But for me, where it falls flat is that her personality just isn't there. Like a lot of this is like her third album, she's 21 now, so this is very much the I'm a Woman Now album, and she's explicitly talking about, you know, her relationships she's having, but it's very cliched.
So stars out of five for Tate McRae from you, Sarah.
It was a 2.5 for me because, you know, I was dancing along to these and they have a radio friendly, a club friendly finish to them.
Cian.
Yeah, I don't think she's... I agree with Sarah. There's not a whole lot of personality in this. They're very anonymous. But I love the way it makes me want to dance. So 3.5.
3.5. 3.5. And 2.5 for Tate McRae. And she's so close to what? Sam Fender's album is People Watching. And The Murder Capital is... The album is called Blindness. That's it for tonight's show. Paula Shields and Liam Murphy were the researchers. Jamie Doyle was on sound. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Reg Luby. John Creedon is next.